couch of potatoes across the country, around the world, on the radio and on the internet. I'm Kevin Carr, and you're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies. On today's show, I'm going to be talking about some Christmas movies that are coming out on this weekend of Christmas. That includes Concussion, Joy, Point Break, Daddy's Home, and Where to Invade Next. I'm also going to be talking about some news, the trailer park, some box office predictions, and of course, the home cinema roundup. But first, if you want to get in touch with me, you can email me at fatguys@fatguysatthemovies.com. You can leave me a voicemail at 740-205-6456. That's 740-205-6456. You can find me on fatguysatthemovies.com or facebook.com/fatguysatthemovies. And if you want to reach out to me on Twitter, you can find me at twitter.com/KevinCarr.
Good evening. I'm Ron Burgundy, and this is what's happening in your world tonight.
Thank you, Ron Burgundy. There really is only one kind of news this week following the giant, massive release of Star Wars The Force Awakens, and that is news that has to do with Star Wars The Force Awakens. This was a juggernaut. This was bigger than I ever thought it would be, and I remember thinking back in the fall and even in the late summer, I was cautioning people against saying that this was going to break box office records, because traditionally, December isn't that time for that to happen. Usually you see these huge numbers posted in the summer or in November, right around Thanksgiving. But so many people are busy around Christmas with Christmas shopping and travel and getting finished with, you know, wrapping up the year and finishing up school. It doesn't seem to be the big push in terms of box office. I was totally wrong with that. Star Wars was indestructible at the box office. It's on its Thursday, just its Thursday, the 17th, where it started shows at 7 o'clock. It made $57 million on basically a half day. Only three other movies in the last 5 months have done that on any weekend, and it was always their opening weekend, and that was Spectre, The Hunger Games, and Straight Outta Compton. All other movies have made less than that, even in their big opening weekend. It also had the highest Friday, which was its highest opening day, and the highest single day of $119 million. Now, that does include that $57 million. It's not like a pure Friday. But still, $119 million, that like puts it as one of the highest grossing movies of the year just within a day, which is unbelievable. And then it had the largest weekend, bested Jurassic World by $40 million. And that's significant because Jurassic World came out just a couple months ago. So it's not like the Titanic comparison where Titanic came out almost 20 years ago. Jurassic World and Star Wars The Force Awakens are as close to a one-to-one comparison as you can get. And it bested by like 20%. That is amazing. It also had the worldwide opening weekend of $529 million. It was well over $700 million before it even went on the air. It's probably going to be hitting $1 billion by the time it finished talking. Now, don't expect Episode 8 and Episode 9 to match this. There was 10 years of anticipation, 30 years since the last episode, Episode 6, being Return of the Jedi. So there's a lot of buildup to this. And so Episode 8's not going to match it. But and still, that says a lot about what Star Wars can do and the power that Star Wars has. Now, another interesting little piece of Star Wars news is I'm a member of the Broadcast Film Critics Association, and we run the Critics' Choice Movie Awards, which you can watch January 17th at 8 p.m. on A&E, Lifetime, and Lifetime Movie Network. We, like a lot of other organizations, held our nominations before we got to see Star Wars, simply because Disney wasn't showing it to anybody, and that's their prerogative. Well, after it came out, a lot of people in the membership were like, wait a minute, this is on my top 10 list for the end of the year, and we didn't get a chance to vote on it. So there was a special vote held to the membership that basically said, hey, would you have put this on the Best Picture list? And it ended up getting on the Best Picture list. The Critics' Choice Movie Awards will be having 11 nominees for Best Picture, and including the 10 that already exist, it's got Star Wars The Force Awakens. They did this once before, about 15 years ago, when Castaway came out, because that was another one that I wasn't in the group at that time, but they didn't get a chance to see it early enough, and they retroactively put it on the Best Picture list. Now, what's funny is there are people out there who are cheesed off at this. There are people that say this is wrong, and they say that we're kowtowing to ratings, you know, basically accusing the BFCA of doing dirty dealings. It's not that. Trust me, it's not that. Here's the thing. Words do mean things. And when you say the best of the year, you kind of should evaluate the entire year. Now, I understand if it was a movie that they held from release completely and then they released it in one theater for one night on December 31st and didn't invite press. Well, there's not a whole lot you can do about that. But this thing opened 2 weeks before the end of the year. It should be considered. These movie organizations, including some of them that I'm part of, like the Online Film Critics Society, which had their awards out at the beginning of December, then they're doing it for ratings and media coverage. But here's the thing. Early awards are silly. They're unprofessional. They're inappropriate. This demonstrates how dumb they are. Hollywood shouldn't kowtow to your nomination's deadline. Ignoring a movie just because a studio wouldn't show it to you weeks early is not professional, and it's not representative of the year of releases. If it's a big movie like this, you shouldn't be doing your awards in November. And to say, well, it's Disney's fault, for if they wanted us to consider it, Disney should have shown it to us. It comes out 2 weeks before the end of the year. How can you be honestly evaluating movies if you don't see all the, at least the major releases? I understand there's a lot of small ones that slip through the cracks, but you know, as a respectable critic organization, you should be evaluating everything. And if they don't show you movies or routinely don't get to show you movies, then you need to change your awards deadline. I know in the OFCS, they didn't care that very few people in the organization had seen The Hateful Eight, and it got no nominations because so few people saw it. Does that mean that Hateful Eight's a bad movie? No, that just means that the OFCS was so egotistical and obnoxious that they wanted to have their awards early that they had them before their membership had a chance to do it. It's not representative of the membership. And it's a crappy award system. So bravo to the BFCA. I would have loved to have seen Star Wars get nominated for Best Action Film, Best Sci-Fi Film, which are also categories, but I'm okay with a Best Picture nomination and actually has a chance of winning some Best Picture nominations because there is no clear front runner. For everyone who likes Sicario and for everyone who likes Spotlight, there's somebody who doesn't in an extreme. There really is no clear front runner. Listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the trailer park. A couple ones I want to talk about. Fantastic Beasts and Where to Find Them. This is the next installment in the Harry Potter world.
Yesterday, a wizard entered New York with a case. A case full of magical creatures. Unfortunately, some have escaped. It was open?
Just a smidge.
This opens in November of 2016, and it's bound to be a huge movie. And you know, there's not much to the trailer, but I'll tell you what it does is it does show the Wizarding World, and it does put it in that context. And it actually kind of made me interested to see it because it tells you what the story's about in a very short and brief way. Without giving too much away, but it makes it interesting, and it's not about Harry Potter. It's not something that hinges on these characters that you already went through 8 movies on. The next one I want to talk about is X-Men Apocalypse. Opens on May 27th. That's Memorial Day weekend.
Tens of thousands of years ago, an ancient being was born, the world's first
mutant.
Wherever this being was, he always had 4 followers he would imbue with power.
Like the 4 horsemen of the apocalypse. You got that one from the Bible.
Or the Bible got it from him.
What is it?
Oh, God. He can control all of us.
What's interesting is both Fantastic Beasts and Where to Find Them and X-Men Apocalypse are directed by the same directors who've been directing the last couple ones in the series. David Yates is doing the Fantastic Beasts, and he's been in the Harry Potter universe since, what, like Order of the Phoenix? And X-Men has been directed by Bryan Singer, and Bryan Singer does a really good job with this stuff, but see, so good with the X-Men, I'm looking forward to it. I liked X-Men Days of Future Past, so this one looks kind of neat. It's bubblegum pop at this point, but I'm okay with that. I actually think 2016 might actually be a better year than 2015 in terms of big blockbusters. That's it for this segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about Daddy's Home and Point Break. Kevin Carr with Fat Guys at the Movies, continuing steaming ahead in our Christmas weekend, looking at some of the movies that have come out at Christmas. The first one I want to highlight is Daddy's Home. Will Ferrell plays a stepfather who gets into a competition with the kid's biological father over who is cooler.
I've always wanted to be a dad. And let me tell you, I love it. Okay, I'm their stepdad. The way I see it, anyone can be a father. But not everyone has the patience or the devotion to be a
daddy!
The king received word that his dominion was being ruled over by some curly-headed stepking with good credit.
Oh, no!
Sounds like your dad's spinning quite a yarn.
Oh, actually, it's getting late.
Aww.
Good night, my little magical cherubs. Good night, back scratches. Oh,
hey, who wants 20 bucks?
Hey!
What?
This is one of those movies that kind of slips through the cracks for me. It was not screened in my hometown of Columbus, Ohio. And I could have gone up to Cleveland to go see it, which is like 2 hours out of my way. But it was like on a Sunday afternoon, and I'd already driven up there on that Saturday to see Alvin and the Chipmunks. And then I was going the following Tuesday to see Star Wars. I just didn't want to do 3 trips to Cleveland in 5 days. So I didn't get a chance to see this. And, you know, it's Christmas weekend. I'm taking the weekend off. I'm not fighting Christmas crowds to go to movies. I spent most of the year going to movies various days of the week, sometimes 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 times a week going to a theater. I'm taking a couple weeks off. It's nice to not have to go into a theater to see a movie for a while. So I didn't get a chance to see this one. My apologies out there to those of you in Radio Land, because I kind of thought this might be an interesting movie. I like Will Ferrell. I like Mark Wahlberg. I think they're both very funny guys. I think they both have a great handle on comedy, and they're very different in their delivery and their style. And when it comes to Will Ferrell, different works often quite well. And that's actually why I liked Get Hard, which was earlier this year. I know a lot of people hated it. I mean, in terms of critics, it did pretty well. But I enjoyed it. I thought it was funny because Will Smith and Kevin Hart were so vastly different of performers. And this one, Mark Wahlberg and Will Ferrell are so different. This one looks like it could be cute. I don't quite know why they're dropping it, though, on Christmas. I think this is going to get crushed because there was already Alvin and the Chipmunks out, and there's like the Peanuts movie and the Good Dinosaur. There is not a loss of family-friendly movies at Christmas this year. Let's not even talk about Star Wars, which is one of those four quadrant releases, but it certainly would draw the crowd that would want to see Daddy's Home. Sort of that family audience. If you've already seen Star Wars, maybe you're going to want to see it. But, you know, I just don't know if this one's going to ride. There's so many movies coming out. It's, I think, going to have some problems. Even though there was a screening in Ohio, it wasn't shown to me, so I have to give it a preemptive suck, because that's the rules. That is how things roll in the magical studio in the sky.
It sucks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. The next film I want to talk about is Point Break. In this remake of the 1991 action flick, a young FBI agent goes undercover to infiltrate a group of extreme athletes he believes is responsible for a series of crimes.
3 crimes, 3 continents.
I think they're connected. They're attempting something called the Ozaki 8, a series of 8 ordeals that honor the forces of nature.
So this is about enlightenment?
Exactly.
What are you doing here, Utah?
Maybe I'm chasing the 8.
A man who pushes his boundaries ultimately finds them.
Come with us.
We have to give more than we take.
There's a story behind this one, very similar to why I didn't see Daddy's Home. Only the weird thing is I saw Point Break. There was a screening in Columbus. I was coming home straight from Cleveland, driving straight from the theater where I saw Star Wars straight to the theater where they were showing Point Break, and I went to go see it. And this has happened, you know, a couple times in my career. Went there, saw the movie, came out, it wasn't very full, not a whole lot of people cared. And the next morning, news hit that Warner Brothers was suddenly pulling all critic screenings for quote-unquote unforeseen circumstances, which generally means that they're afraid of what the reviews are going to say. Then later on, I get an email from my publicist that says, hey, you know, this is embargoed until Christmas morning. And I'm like, well, that's great. When am I going to talk about it on the radio? You know, in terms of like my call-ins and when I do interviews on other stations, because I'm not working on Christmas. I'm not going to be doing a dozen call-ins on Christmas morning. I'm opening presents with my kids, man. So it's such a bizarre string of events. And I got a chance to see it, but I wasn't able to talk about it to anybody. And this is really the only chance I get to, because it's out now, and the embargo's lifted. The weird thing about Point Break as a remake is the original movie's not like it's untouchable. It's not like it's this pristine, beautiful movie that to remake it would kind of trample on an action legend. Like, if they tried to actually remake Die Hard, not make another sequel, but remake Die Hard, That just seems crass at this point. That's Die Hard's such a classic. It was like when they remade Psycho. It's just like, why? It's kind of like that perfect movie. It exists in its own time. Point Break isn't necessarily like that. Point Break, I'm not even going to argue that the original Point Break's a good movie. I mean, it's directed by Oscar winner Kathryn Bigelow, but this was back when she was making crappy action films like Blue Steel. The thing that's interesting about Point Break is it's so memorable. It was the first time that Keanu Reeves really got a big action role. Before that, he'd been doing stuff like Bill and Ted's and smaller parts. And of course, it had Patrick Swayze, who was huge at the time. Patrick Swayze, I think, was coming off a Ghost, probably his biggest hit in his career. I don't know if it was bigger than Dirty Dancing, but it was way up there. And then it had Gary Busey as this sort of bizarre extra character. And he was insane, but he was a lot of fun in the movie. So it was very memorable, and of course they do the whole thing in Hot Fuzz where the character's talking about how great Point Break was and the scene where he's shooting in the air. There's something timeless about the original one, and so they could have remade it, but they kind of remade it in the worst way possible. First of all, they changed the story enough to make it really dumb. Because in the original movie, it was just a bunch of surfers who were funding their lifestyle by robbing banks around L.A., and so the FBI went after them. And then they sent Keanu Reeves undercover. Well, that all made sense. In this one, they're globe-trotting, sort of eco-terrorists/freedom fighters, and they're these extreme athletes, so they do everything. And they're trying to achieve these 8 goals. And they're doing them in all these different countries. And I'm like, how the heck does the FBI have jurisdiction over this? I mean, there's a scene in there where they're like in Italy and they're chasing them. Now the FBI are just running around with guns. The Italians aren't just going to let the FBI run in there and take over their local law enforcement. That's like another country's police force. You don't allow that. It just is so silly at this point. But the biggest problem was the original movie had a great cast. It took Keanu Reeves before he was an action guy, but he was at least a known quantity. Nobody knows who these guys, Luke Bracey and Edgar Ramirez. Does anyone know who these guys are? They're the stars. They're the Keanu Reeves and Patrick Swayze of the new Point Break. I think what happened was Warner Brothers said, okay, let's roll the dice. And these guys, if they take off, we should catch them right in their popularity. And they just never took off. Nobody cares about this movie. And it has some cool extreme stunt footage, but you can get that by watching YouTube for a couple hours. Other than that, it's an entirely forgettable movie, and that's kind of like the worst type of movie that, you know, in 10 years are going to be like, oh yeah, they did do a Point Break remake, didn't they? Wow. It wasn't awful. It wasn't like a terror. It's not going to make my top 10 worst list of the year, but it's just an unforgettable, who cares kind of movie, sort of like the remake of Poltergeist. Ultimately, Point Break kind of sucks.
It kind of sucks.
Wait a second. I don't like the sound of that.
That's it for the segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about the award contenders, Concussion and Joy. Kevin Carr with Fat Guys at the Movies, continuing with the movie reviews. In this segment, we're going to look at the two new releases that are coming out Christmas that are up for award consideration. So I actually had a chance to see these a while ago. Concussion's had a little bit more traction than Joy has. Will Smith has gotten a couple nominations here and there, and with good reason. I mean, he does a good job in this role. But let's start with that one. Let's start with Concussion. Will Smith plays a pathologist who uncovers the danger of head injuries in football and butts heads, no pun intended, with the NFL when he tries to publicize the results.
In 25 years, I've never requested a test like this. What are you looking for?
Repetitive head trauma chokes the brain. It turns you into someone else.
Tape, needles, Vicodin, Toradol. Whatever it takes to keep them in the game, it's business.
Get me a meeting with the commissioner. They don't want to talk to you.
The NFL has known about the concussion issue for years.
Will Smith is one of the few bona fide movie stars in the United States. Everyone claims to be a movie star. I'm sure that Luke Bracey and Edgar Ramirez at some point from Point Break were claiming they were movie stars. They're not. But Will Smith is definitely a bona fide movie star. He's the kind of guy who can open a movie. He's the kind of guy who can put his picture and his name on the poster, and you're going to get people going to see the movie. And that's not going to be an unending thing. At some point, if he does a string of bombs, people will just stop paying attention. But he's kind of pulled back from doing the movies. He had some rough times, you know, when he gave his son Jaden the leading role in After Earth and movies like that. Even 7 Pounds, which is terrible, but it did extremely well overseas, and it made enough box office to really still make him a bona fide bankable name. But Concussion is him stepping back from the would-be blockbusters like I Am Legend and Hancock and the Men in Black movies and doing something a little more award-worthy. His character is a Nigerian doctor who lives and works in Pittsburgh. And the problem with that kind of a role sometimes is it's really easy to slip into caricature because it has such a distinct accent. And I give Smith credit. He never stumbles into that. He feels very authentic. He feels like the character. He doesn't feel like he's putting on a show. It has a good cast. It has like Gugu Mbatha-Raw's in it. And I love her, but she just doesn't give him much to do in the movie. Hers is a wasted storyline. The only other actor that really kind of brings real note is Albert Brooks as Cyril Wecht, who is this character's boss. But beyond the performance, it's an interesting issue. And it's a daring issue because it shows, as Mickey Mouse as you can, you know, boiling down that medical terminology for just your average viewer, it shows you how dangerous this can be. It shows you how dangerous being on a football field for that long and that chronically, what that can do to a person. And that's important because I know that everyone says baseball is America's pastime, but really football is what I see more often as being the focus of people's free time. Not to play it, but just to watch it. And a lot of people put their kids in. I'm from Ohio. I'm from Columbus, Ohio. Ohio State is a huge deal. And we've got the Browns in Cleveland, which is not that big of a deal, unless Steve Hardy's going to announce them as the winners of the Super Bowl. You know, and you got the Cincinnati Bengals. And of course, you got Pittsburgh is only 3 hours away from me, where you got the Steelers. I mean, I'm in football country. And you're taking on the NFL. And they even say in the trailer at one point, I don't think you heard this in what I played, but they say this is the corporation that essentially owns a day of the week. This falls in line with a comparison to other movies like The Big Short and Spotlight, which are movies that have this one person or a group of people uncovering some problem and trying to convince other people that the problem's happening and going up against a big entity. Now, in Spotlight, they're going up the Catholic Church. In The Big Short, they're going up against Wall Street. And this one, he's going up against the NFL. And it's an interesting and a significant discussion to have because we have to look at how dangerous this is. And the reason this is so important in the way the movie's told is because it's not just somebody getting hit in the head. It's the chronic repeating injuries that happen that aren't detectable on a standard CAT scan. And there's a huge number of athletes, especially in football, that are having the problem. And I think what it's really calling for is not a banning of football, not a stopping of football, not a stopping of having kids play football. But what it's doing is asking for an acknowledgement that there's a problem. It's sort of like boxing. If you're going to go into boxing, everybody knows if you go into boxing, it's dangerous. People know you go into boxing, you're going to get hit in the head a lot, and you are going to possibly suffer brain damage, among other damages that are going to happen to your body. You know that's dangerous. That's like starting smoking. Nobody at this point is saying that smoking's not bad for you, but people still start doing it. But at least they know that it's bad for you going in. And I think that's the problem that we see with football is football is seen and other sports too, you know, even cheerleading and soccer and some of these other sports that involve collisions of some sort or potential collisions can be a very dangerous thing. So that's why I think Concussion is probably a more significant movie than it necessarily is a great movie. It's a good movie. It's worth seeing. And I recommend it, but it's more important to start a national conversation. So I'm going to have to say Concussion kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about Joy. Jennifer Lawrence plays a struggling housewife who invents a miracle mop and tries to build a business out of its success.
I was valedictorian in high school. I got into a fancy college. I stay here because my parents are getting divorced. I have real ambitions and real ideas.
We're making an invention, and it's very serious.
Joy's never run a business in her entire life.
It's my fault. I gave her the confidence to think she was more than just an unemployed housewife.
I don't want to end up like my family.
I have to do things myself once and for all.
Okay, Godspeed. Good luck. Here we go.
This is directed and written by David O. Russell, who did films like American Hustle and Silver Linings Playbook. And in a way, this is a bit of a reunion of Silver Linings Playbook because it has Jennifer Lawrence in it. And it's got Bradley Cooper, and he's a much smaller role here. I mean, he's the main character in Silver Linings. Here, he's just sort of a... You don't even meet him until an hour into the movie. And Robert De Niro, who's playing her father, which is, you know, he was playing Bradley Cooper's father in Silver Linings Playbook. But you have that family life, that very uncomfortable, snarky, problematic, and awkward family life of Jennifer Lawrence's character, of Joy. And I wasn't as into that as I was into sort of like the cat and mouse game of the business angle and how her character's trying to work her way into this cutthroat business world and deal with the shysters and deal with the problems and deal with the cheats and deal with the people who want to take advantage of her and how she handles it. And while there's huge liberties taken with the storyline, because I think it started as a biopic but ended up just becoming a fictionalized account, and at no point is it trying to say this actually happened. And I applaud the movie for that, because too many times they say based on a true story and there's very little truth in it. But those scenes of the business angle and the dirty dealings of the back rooms, those are the ones that I found interesting. Sort of like the quirky, weird, uncomfortably obnoxious home life is, it's just not my cup of tea. It's very David O. Russell. And what's funny is this movie's not getting a whole lot of praise from critics. I'm sort of the odd man out with this movie. I actually liked it. I thought it was better than Silver Linings Playbook, and because I didn't particularly like Silver Linings Playbook. I thought American Hustle was good. I thought Jennifer Lawrence was a hoot in American Hustle, even though she was very much a supporting character in that. This one, she owns the movie. This is her film, and it gives her a chance to shine. And it's an important role for her because, you know, even though she's been doing stuff like The Hunger Games, and you could say that those are definitely her movies, she's been doing a lot of movies that involve ensemble casts, you know, going all the way from X-Men up to American Hustle and even Silver Linings Playbook. Those were ones where she's just not going it alone. This one, you really feel like she goes it alone. And it's a shame that it's not getting more accolades now, because I think that's good for her. It's a good movie for her, and I enjoyed it. I thought it was worth seeing and interesting, and it's not going to win awards from the critics, but that's okay. It's not necessarily made for the critics. I think audiences in general are going to respond to it better than critics have. So in the end, Joy kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
That's it for this segment. One more movie to talk about in the next one, and that is Where to Invade Next. I'll also be talking about the box office and the home cinema roundup. Car with Fat Guys at the Movies, moving into the final movie review, and this one is a documentary by everyone's favorite documentarian, Michael Moore. I say that with my tongue firmly in my cheek, although if I said that with my tongue firmly in my cheek, it'd be Michael Moore, but then you wouldn't understand what I was saying. Anyways, Michael Moore once again sets his political target on American culture as he travels the world to prove everyone is better than the United States in Where to Invade Next.
My mission? I will invade countries with names I can mostly pronounce. Take the things we need from them and bring it all back home. Because we have problems no army could solve. The American dream seemed to be alive and well everywhere but America. What's your plan?
tomorrow, you believe
it. We stay together. We open our hearts. We open our society.
If they can do it, surely we can.
I have had an interesting history covering Michael Moore because it started out when I was younger and I remember seeing Roger and Me and thinking, wow, this is an interesting documentary. It's an eye-opening documentary and it was well done. One of the things Michael Moore did, especially with Roger and Me, is he brought a special brand of humor and personalization to the story, so it wasn't a typical documentary. And he got in trouble at times for sequence of events and not portraying things exactly how they occurred and sort of manufacturing a bit of a reality for Roger and Me. And those are valid concerns and those are valid criticisms. I think he did sort of introduce the world to a more whimsical, more of a commentary film than a documentary film. And of course, he made it big. Well, he did it really big with Bowling for Columbine, but he made it really big with Fahrenheit 9/11. It's kind of just an advantage. He took advantage of a situation. Around the time Fahrenheit 9/11 had finished up in the box office, I used to work in independent film, and I was approached by a guy from Flint who wanted help putting together a documentary about Michael Moore. Now, this guy was funny. A lot of people say, oh, he must have been a Republican, diehard conservative. No, this guy was a liberal Democrat. At the time, it was coming up to the 2004 election. He was a big Kerry supporter. But he didn't like Michael Moore because Michael Moore was not trustworthy. And I helped him with his documentary. It's called Shooting Michael Moore. I'm sure you can find it. Just search it on the internet. It's an interesting documentary because it picks apart a lot of Michael Moore's history. It shows his dishonesty. And it shows how that then is transferred into his films. Now, what's interesting is because of this, we also dissected how he did other documentaries, including Sicko and particularly Roger and Me, because it took place in Flint. And over the course of working on this movie, I discovered there's a huge level of dishonesty in how Michael Moore presents his films. And ever since that, I've looked at his films with a ton of skepticism. His stuff feels cool. His stuff seems to work right. But I know a lot of his tricks in sort of obfuscating the truth and not giving the full story. A great example is how he goes down to Cuba and he goes to this hospital and brings these people, these 9/11 rescue workers down to this hospital in Cuba in Sicko. You could never do that. This isn't the hospital he takes them to is not open to the public in Cuba. Even though it's a communistic country and everyone's supposed to have access, they send you to the crappy hospital. That hospital is reserved for party officials. And there's a lot of stuff that he just sweeps under the rug because he has a very specific political agenda. And in this movie, in Where to Invade Next, his political agenda is essentially America's a big bunch of fat idiots who don't know anything and we love our guns and we're obnoxious. Let's go over to these other countries and find out what they do and just show how revolutionary they are. But he doesn't show the real story and he doesn't show where stuff may be very similar in the U.S. And he uses assumption and logical fallacy to get people to believe that what's happening in these movies is authentic. And it may, in fact, be something that's reflected in the United States. He might be misrepresenting a lot of the views of the United States and the day-to-day workings of the United States. Knowing his techniques and how when he gets the answer he wants, is that's what he puts on the screen. He doesn't worry about whether there's actually a truth behind that. Or, I mean, you can go to a country and talk to one person and get a story and go talk to another person and get a totally different version of the story. He goes to the people who he wants to hear from. He does not do investigative journalism. He does op-ed pieces that are meant to support his preconceived notion that Europe and these other countries are just inherently better than America because they're not America. There is a certain level of him just not liking America. That's just the way Michael Moore is. And this is, I think, the most disingenuous of the ones I've seen lately. Where to Invade Next? It's a mess of a movie. It doesn't have a real focus. It's going to go over well with people who love European culture and wish America to be just like Europe, even though we're not, because we're very different. And the history and the politics and the culture and the setup of the nation is just very different. I mean, there's so many differences between America and the European Union, you can't compare a lot of things. And he uses a lot of logic flaws in this and just doesn't do a very good job. So Where to Invade Next sucks.
It sucks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about the box office. I talked a little bit about Star Wars. I had predicted $220 million, and I thought that was being pretty generous. I saw people predicting close to $250 million, and I'm like, no way. Star Wars isn't going to make that one, not in December. It almost made that. It made $248 million, which is unprecedented. And on top of it, and this is more significant, a big movie opening like this is less important than the legs that this movie would have. For example, the Twilight movies, let's use those. Especially once you got to the fourth and fifth Twilight movie, those movies had huge openers, but they were extremely front-loaded, and they dropped off really fast, and so whatever they made in their first weekend, they doubled that, and that's about what they made in their entire box office run. Star Wars is probably going to have doubled its opening weekend by the end of this weekend. Partly because it's had such a great hold throughout the week. Leading up till Christmas, I mean, it was doing close to $40 million a day. Put that in perspective, $40 million a day for Friday, Saturday, and Sunday gives you a $120 million weekend. Those are massive summertime movie numbers. And Star Wars is doing it on a Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday when people are Christmas shopping. That is how staggering the Star Wars opening was. But yeah, $248 million. Alvin and the Chipmunks and Sisters both came in right around $14 million. It was kind of a horse race. And Alvin and the Chipmunks won. And that's pretty small for an Alvin and the Chipmunks movie because these things used to do big numbers. But I think they just squeaked it out there, no pun intended, right under Star Wars. Sisters is doing fine for the budget that it was spent on. And it's a fun movie. The bottom line is more people going to see Star Wars means more people are going to the movies. And so you're going to get the trickle-down effect in the movie theaters. So what's going to happen this weekend? I don't know. What last week I said a kajillion dollars for Star Wars. Well, let's say half a kajillion dollars. I mean, seriously, this movie, I would suggest that it could make $150 million on Christmas weekend, because Christmas is always a huge day for movies. And then you've got Saturday and Sunday. $150 million, I mean, that's $50 million a day. That's for the size of this movie, when it's making $40 million on Monday and $37 million on Tuesday, sure, it could bump up to $50 million a day through the weekend. And then you got no school between Christmas and New Year's, and so even more money. So yeah, I think $150 million for Star Wars. Nothing else is going to come close. You know, these other movies might make $20 million, $10 million for the award ones. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the world-famous home cinema roundup. Handful of films in case you want to plop down your gift cards or go up to Amazon, and if you've got a little bit of credit there from Christmas, either returned gifts or maybe a gift card or some money that you want to spend. You have Pan, and you know, Pan, I think Pan got a bum rap. I really liked Pan. I watched it again, and it doesn't quite hold up as much as I enjoyed it in theaters. And there's some terrible things about it. I mean, Garrett Hedlund is bonkers insane in this movie. And he delivers all of his dialogue like Jack Nicholson in the Three Little Pigs monologue in The Shining. But it's a visually arresting and stunning movie. It looks really cool, and it's a neat retelling of the Pan legend. I just don't think anyone was looking for a Peter Pan movie. But it looks gorgeous, and it's worth seeing. If you haven't seen it, it feels like a good old holiday movie to me. Pawn Sacrifice, the story of Bobby Fischer. It didn't get any big award nominations, but if you're a big fan of chess, you can check out Pawn Sacrifice. And then finally, some TV series on Sci-Fi Channel. You've got Defiance, Season 3, and Dominion, Season 2. And that's it for me this week. Next week, I'm going to be talking about The Hateful Eight, Anomalisa, and my picks for best and worst movies of 2015. Until then, have a fat time at the movies.